from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South, recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story as if they were sitting on the porch with you. So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Bonnie Montgomery? What'd y'all think? Y'all like Bonnie? She has CDs for sale after the show, and you can hear more at BonnieMontgomeryMusic.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? What do y'all think about our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? On tonight's show, our stories are all about the power of love, as our writers wrestle with, try to trick, or are eventually overpowered by Cupid. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Sandra Spotts Hamilton takes Cupid along on her first trip away from home. And we'll end the night with Jennifer Armstrong as she tries to dodge the proverbial arrows. But let's start the night with Jennifer Winningham as she once again bribes Cupid, only to get stuck in a familiar cycle in Rinse and Repeat.
New Year's morning, 18 months after I had been a bridesmaid and not the bride in William's wedding, Mom woke me with the news that William and his wife had just split. Now, it wouldn't be polite for me to tell you why, but understand that I sat right up in bed and about the soon-to-be ex-wife said, "That meanie!" Except I used a stronger word. And I was surprised that Mom did not scold me for saying that which I'd never uttered in her presence before. In fact, she was right there with me. Yeah! Now, I'm not proud of it, but on their wedding day, I prayed that God would destroy the church. We bridesmaids were dressing in our floral cotton dresses that were supposed to be dropped waist and T-length, but they were really just below the knee. We wore white stockings and pink low-heel pumps. Each of us bridesmaids carried a different color bouquet and sported a floppy hat. Mine, yellow. I guess I didn't think past the church being destroyed by God or any other natural disaster. They could have married anywhere. But despite my pleas to the Almighty, the wedding went off without a hitch. But now that there's going to be a divorce, well, let's just say things were getting back to normal. It had all started on a cold fall weekend night when I was in the fifth or sixth grade. A dozen or so of us preteens and teens were on a wooden trailer with some chaperones sitting on some hay strewn about. And I've pretty much always been about comfort and convenience. And clearly this was neither of those. But I was so happy to be there. This was the church hayride. And William had agreed to come with me. And we were holding hands under the quilt. Now, do you remember some of your first hand-holding? When it's hard to tell which palm is sweating more than the other one or who's more than the other? So Hot Child in the City might not have provided the soundtrack that the church leadership would have approved. But with a suave flip, William positioned the quilt over our heads, and the moment was here. My first kiss was of the international persuasion. And it was big, and I liked it. Well, that was it. As he intended or not, William had firmly established himself as my first love. The next Monday at school, I wondered if people could tell that I'd been kissed just by looking at me. Throughout the rest of our school days, we would break up and get back together and just be really good friends and date other people and get back together, rinse and repeat. In seventh grade, he was my homecoming escort. Just as in many couples of that age, I was a head taller than him. As juniors, he and I were selected to be in an all-school play in Hot Springs. Kids from all over the state, we had studied our lines, came together in Hot Springs, and performed this play a few times over one weekend. In our class play, we had the lead roles, and we shared a kiss on stage. At high school graduation, he and I just happened to end up side by side during the recessional. I'm not sure when he decided to become a pharmacist. He worked some in my dad's local drugstore. I dreamed of the possibilities. We'd go off to college and pharmacy school and just have a grand time growing up and our bond growing deeper all the time. Eventually, we'd return home and help Dad out with his store and eventually take it over completely when he was ready to slow down and retire. In the meantime, just a year after high school, it was time to plan the wedding. And I was bridesmaid. Fast forward through the marriage. So when the divorce got all shook out, he and I dated again. He escorted me to senior year sorority formal, which was an all-weekend thing, and I was in heaven. We were a pretty cute couple. I honestly can't remember why that one ended, but it did, and it was fine. And I dated lots more fellas of varying quality. Don't we all? A few years later, I was teaching at ASU, enjoying a full life with adventures with friends and family. And one night, I was entertaining a nice young man in my home. Very simple dinner and light conversation. The phone rang, and it was William. He was in Jonesboro for a one-month rotation, finishing his pharmacy school requirements. How awkward. So I get rid of that other guy immediately. William came over the next night. And as I was cooking our dinner in this very tiny galley kitchen, he suddenly appears at my side and he goes, "Well, you know I love you." Well, what would you say in such a situation? I bet it would not be, "That does not make me very happy." Yeah, it was an odd response. We talked about it. It was my frustration with all of the back and forth, "Is you is or is you ain't my baby," that we danced around for like 15 years by this time. Mentally exhausting. So we spent some time together that winter month. I would have preferred more time, like every waking but not working moment. The last day of the month, he came to campus to get his resumes that I had prepared and copied for him, and to say goodbye, of course. I met him outside in the parking lot, and it was a cold day, much like that hayride several years ago. We hugged. I don't remember if there was a kiss. In the awkwardness standing there, feeling almost like we were back in elementary school, I asked if I could call him. He said, "I'll call you." I knew he would not. As I watched him literally walk out of my life, I wondered why I wasn't far more upset. I mean, shouldn't I feel all forlorn and desperate if this relationship is finally ending? William turned the corner, And as I walked back to my office and back to my life and back to my future, I realized that for the first time since the fifth grade, William and I had just stepped off the merry-go-round that had been us. And as the cold wind blew back my hair, I knew I was going to be just fine.
Jennifer Winningham develops training at Verizon. She's taught in ASU's Department of Journalism and worked in marketing for a small private company. Jennifer first found love in Bradford, Arkansas, then Jonesboro, and then Little Rock. In our next story, Sandra spots Hamilton straddles the line between child and woman, and love is in the air in Becoming Audrey Hepburn.
My best friend Elaine and I woke up on our first morning in Kansas City, Missouri, to discover that we were both to have blind dates to the country club luau. We were on our first trip without our parents to visit our aunts a whole state away from Arkansas, and I was certain that my parents had not been consulted about this little item on the agenda because dating was not an allowable activity anywhere in my near future. At home, anyway. My Aunt Maylene, an exquisite hobbyist seamstress, was no doubt frustrated by having only two boys and longed to sew for a girl. She planned an outing to the fabric shop and then designed and sewed up a special skirt. It involved long tails all the way around that fell from the waistband so that when I did the twist, the tails would become airborne, flaring out and adding to the twisting effect and my sauciness. Something about the mood of 1962 in America led all young girls, including me, to believe that they would suddenly, one morning, be Audrey Hepburn. They would, upon waking in their white French provincial beds, be relieved of baby fat, braces, blemishes, frizzy hair, and social awkwardness with boys. It would be automatic and complete. Flannel nightgowns and cotton baby doll pajamas would be transformed into tasteful black negligees. And orthodontic headgear would be replaced by satin sleeping blindfolds. Rolls of baby fat would give way to frames so thin that hip bones protruded. No effort, pain, or sacrifice would be involved. Becoming a sophisticated lady was easy. That summer leading up to the trip, I waited. I wanted. I pined. I listened incessantly to Moon River. I had no grasp of the concept of creating my own fate. My destiny was in the stars, beyond my grasp. It never dawned on me that had this miracle happened, it would have been news heard round the world. I probably would have been offered an audience with the Pope, who would have surely marveled at such a miracle. After all, I was a chubby, red-headed, and freckle-faced 14-year-old living in Arkansas, so the chances of being mistaken for a young Audrey were incalculable. As I waited for the Audreyization of my being, I alternated daily between spending time with my Barbie, but strictly in her employ as her interior designer, and experimenting with my own upswept hairdos and modeling poses. One foot was squarely still in childhood, while the other longed to don black patent heels. My frame began to thin in some places and curve in others, and I mastered the art of applying pancake makeup, eyeliner, and mascara. Mother Nature and Maybelline had lent a hand. Then the old lady must have swept her wand across my rooftop because my friend Elaine and I were issued an invitation that could potentially become our ticket out of our mundane childhoods and into life as sophisticated adults. Both of us had aunts in Kansas City, Missouri, who had invited us to visit any time. We plotted together, lobbied our parents, and extracted more specific dates for a trip to happen. A week later, the bus doors closed and we were headed for our particular Paris, Kansas City, Missouri. The Greyhound might as well have been an Aston Martin racing through the French countryside. We waved to our parents through the bug-specked window and then toasted each other with imaginary champagne flutes. Bon voyage, darling, we bade each other in newly acquired British accents. At long last, we arrived at the Kansas City bus station and were greeted by Elaine's Aunt Z, who drove us to her downtown apartment. She proved to be exactly the glamorous lady I had imagined from the stories Elaine had told me. She floated around the apartment, a word that in itself oozed sophistication, in a negligee, smoked and drank martinis, while playing Sinatra records from her vast collection stacked on the floor. We only stayed one night with Z, an arrangement that I figured had a lot to do with the fact that she had a man friend who had been exiled for the night. The next morning, we called my aunt and uncle, who picked us up and took us to their suburban home, furnished with the clutter of collectors who would rather be on the go than have pristine homes. Since Uncle Mal was an airline pilot, the family schedule might include dinner at 10 p.m., staying up until 1, and sleeping until noon. All decadent stuff for a girl whose dad woke her at 7 on Saturdays, with the caveat, if you sleep all day, you won't amount to anything. There was a go-kart track in the backyard, and my two boy cousins' collections of Henry J. and Model A cars, along with my uncle's gigantic ham radio tower. This sort of extravagant man stuff was foreign to us both, but bode well for the visit, for cousins who are boys have friends who are boys, whom they like to introduce to the new girls in town. And then the blind date invitation. The fix-up proved to be a successful one because my Kansas City prince and I were mesmerized by strains of Moon River, sugary Shirley Temples, and each other. We spent the next 2 weeks dancing, swimming, and smooching in the rumble seat of my cousin's restored Model A. Elaine's date with my smitten and much older cousin worked out nicely as well until my aunt later intervened, deeming the age difference inappropriate. That attraction had severely cut into my cousin's work time in his dad's basement side business. Then the dreaded time came when my parents arrived in Kansas City to take us back home. My dad, not one to dally when there was a road trip involved, woke up the next day in serious trip mode. While my prince and I were saying our goodbyes, I was mortified to hear my father's Arkansas twang on the phone extension. All reservoir, arrivederci, sayonara, y'all come. And hang up, shorty, we've got a long drive. Promises to see each other next year and to write all through the school year were made and kept throughout our early college years. When we arrived home, I walked into what looked way too much like a little girl's bedroom. I pulled out the chalkboard floor plan of Barbie's latest penthouse and erased it. Then I picked up Barbie from her Velveeta cheese box sofa. And later on the top closet shelf. I opened my train case and pulled out a rose with brown edges and placed it behind my ear. Then I began to hum Moon River.
Sandra Spotts Hamilton graduated from the University of Arkansas with a degree in art and a minor in English. She lives in Little Rock, where she designs interiors for real-life Barbies and frequently hums an off-key rendition of Moon River. In our final story of the night, Jennifer Armstrong thinks she knows what she wants, but Cupid has another plan in mind altogether in Until December.
Did Maeve tell you we have a new roommate? Ginny said, taking a drag off her cigarette while we took a break from practicing for the Mr. Ohio Valley pageant. For the last 5 years, I've been choreographing Arkansas's premier group of drag kings. After the only lesbian bar in Central Arkansas shut down, the group performances stopped, and individual pageants, prides, and benefits began. Ginny's wife, Maeve, already won Mr. Indiana and was prepping her and Ginny's costumes for nationals. No, I replied, fiddling with my lighter. Another queen? You guys are dangerously close to turning into the halfway house for homeless gays. I've always been the straight girl in my group of friends. Through high school, college, my sorority, a marriage, a child, and divorce. Through strings of failed relationships, unsatisfying and sometimes satisfying intimacy. Through love and loss, growing up and moving on, I've always surrounded myself, immersed myself in gay culture. When I was pregnant with my son, I used to joke that I hoped he'd be gay. I did. His first outfit he ever wore was his pee flag onesie, and when he was 3 months old, I took him to his first gay rights protest. Much like those annoying girls that only hang out with guys because, oh my God, other women are so catty. I completely surrounded myself with lesbians. My Facebook friends list reads like a veritable who's who of the L word for Central Arkansas. Gay pride, I was there. Protest march against Prop 8, dude, I'll be shoe polishing signs all night. Some bigoted educator comes out against an LGBTQ group at his school, I've got directions to the sit-in. I was always the hetero, however, wearing my straight but not narrow shirt with pride. Ginny laughed, tossing her long blonde hair over her shoulders. It's another king. She's from Oklahoma. How's her talent? I asked, figuring if I was going to be choreographing for two national performances, I could always throw another into the mix. Ginny and Maeve shared a knowing look. Goofy, Maeve replied, leaning back over her presentation jacket. I looked at Ginny expectantly, and she continued where Maeve left off. Her piece, she started, is goofy. Not awkward goofy, but like the actual goofy music from the cartoon. Ginny trailed off. She wore a green unitard, Maeve deadpanned, briefly looking up from her stoning and raising one eyebrow. Good Lord, I chortled and thought to myself, great, another doughy lesbian who can't dance. This is gonna be interesting. Rehearsal commenced and I forgot about the conversation until practice was over. Where's the roomie? I asked Ginny, heading into the kitchen to grab a bottle of water. She's right here, Ginny responded, and I turned to look in the direction of the hallway and stopped and stared some more. Like, if I'm going to be honest, I've always found women attractive. And I mean, I had sort of been with women before, from like girl crushes to, you know, that phase in my 20s. But me personally, no, I was always straight. But here was this girl in front of me, just standing there being a girl in her beanie and her jeans and her slip-on Vans, as if she didn't realize or didn't really care that she was throwing off the entire balance of my universe by standing there and being a girl. I came back to awareness to find Ginny snapping her fingers in my face. Hello. Hey, she said, waving her hand in front of my eyes. Anything else we need to go over tonight? I did my best to shake my head no, still blatantly staring at the girl in front of me. Okay, Ginny sighed, taking the iPod off its dock and returning to the break room. I'm gonna go smoke a cigarette. I robotically followed Ginny into the back part of the house where Maeve had moved on to applying zippers to Ginny's evening wear. Walk normal, I told myself. Seriously, why are you breathing like that? Do you always breathe so damn loud? Jesus, you sound like Darth Vader with a sinus infection. Don't look at her. Don't look at her. Just walk past her like you're supposed to be here. What, is she coming? Should I ask her to come smoke? What if she doesn't smoke? What if she thinks smoking is gross? Oh my God, what if she thinks I'm gross? Why didn't you wash your hair today? Okay, just play it cool. Oh my God, do I smell bad? I have been dancing for 3 hours. What if I smell bad? Oh my God, what if I'm sweaty? Can she smell that? Do lesbians have super smell powers? Maybe I should go to the bathroom and check. No, she's in the hallway. If I go to the bathroom, I have to pass her in the hallway. And I mean, I can't pass her in the hallway. I'll have to say something to her. I can't just like walk past her like some mute idiot. Okay, just walk to the break room. Just left foot, right foot, and breathe. But don't walk like that. And don't breathe so damn loud. After taking my own personal green mile into the back of the house and attempting to sit down in an oh-so-grateful way, which probably looked more like a giraffe trying to get into a Volkswagen, I busied myself with trying to light a cigarette and not look at this girl who made me want to laugh and vomit all at the same time. Jenda's choreography, Jenny commented, reaching for her laptop. I'm going to show her your talent piece from Mr. Arkansas. The girl just raised an eyebrow and took a sip from her water bottle, as if that was the most normal thing, as if everything was normal, and I was just some other person for her to meet. Yeah, I stammered. I mean, I can always help with your pieces. I mean, I've done Jenny's piece for the last 5 years, and I'm working on Maeve's piece for Nationals, so I can always, you know, help you with your piece and stuff. I just, you know, really like to dance, and I really like lesbians. Oh, God, Jen, seriously? Shut up. Shut up, shut up. I screamed at myself in my head. I mean, lesbians are awesome. What the hell are you saying? Stop talking. The war between what my head was saying and what my mouth was producing wasn't really turning out in my favor. The girl just looked at me, which made me babble even more. I mean, if you wanted me to, I could totally help you out. Not that you need it or anything. I'm sure you're a good dancer. I mean, you have a nice body. I bet you move well. I turned beet red, realizing what I said to her. For dancing. I bet you move well for dancing. Is that an iPhone? She works for Apple, Ginny interjected, still loading the video on her laptop. Oh yeah? I have an iPhone too, I said. It's white. I wanted the white one because it was pretty. Not that the black ones aren't pretty. I'm not like racist or anything. My best friend is black and a lesbian. Did I mention that I like lesbians? The rational voice inside my head had long since committed suicide, leaving me all alone with my neuroses. Ginny played the girl's talent piece, and honestly, I don't remember a damn bit of it. I was too busy running an internal check of my nervous system and directing my body to function normally. Somehow, possibly on Ginny's insistence, the girl and I exchanged numbers, and through October and November, we played the long, drawn-out, getting-to-know-you game under the pretense of just being friends. Because I was straight. That's who I was, the straight girl with all the lesbian friends. At least until December.
Jennifer Armstrong is a mother of one who graduated from the University of Central Arkansas with a baccalaureate in sociology. She has been the director of academic tutoring for the state of Arkansas for the past 2 years. Her desire is to help change the world one student at a time. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? What y'all think? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.